Okay, so this next section is a Q&A session, so this is the time for you to clear up all your doubts. So all those of you who are fully enlightened, please do not ask any questions. And those of you who are not yet fully enlightened, mainly because I'd be embarrassed if you ask questions if you're fully enlightened. But if you're not fully enlightened, then please ask many, many questions. Because if you ask a stupid question, you'll be stupid for a minute. But if you don't ask a stupid question, you'll be stupid for the rest of your life. As I mentioned yesterday, one of the things that I've found, because when I'm in Sydney, I teach very often with the Sri Lankan community in Sydney, and one of the things that I've noticed is that when it comes to asking questions and things, that very often the Sri Lankan community is very, very shy and very hesitant to start asking questions. But at the same time, once they've got started, you can't get them to stop. Once you kind of get going, then you'd like to chat about Dhamma. Anyway, do we have any written questions? Okay, we're just writing right now. So anybody have any? But just before we start, I might just mention that one small change in the program. I'm not sure if this was mentioned earlier, but from 12 to 1, we're going to be having interviews, meditation interviews, as well as from 4 till 4:30. So if you want to have a short meditation interview in those times, then please put your name down, and the list will be, where will the list be? Prem, where will the list for interviews? At the back there, okay. So if you don't know what a meditation interview is, just put your name down anyway and come along and find out, okay? So basically the idea is just to have a bit of a chance to connect, get to know each other, and to ask if you've got any questions about meditation or anything else that's causing doubt or whatever, then that's a chance to have a bit of a chat, that's all. Okay. So, questions, please. Anyone have any questions from the floor? No? I can start with reading them. All right. Well, the first one isn't really a question. Thank you very much. I'm so happy that I was able to be here and listen to you. Less confused now. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Well, that's very good. I'm glad you're less confused. Next one. Thanks for the orientation about meditation. My question is, what do we mean by... What do I mean when I'm saying, what do you bring to meditation? Okay, so when I was talking earlier, I said that the crucial thing in meditation is not so much the method and so on, but what we bring to it. So I'm just talking about what are the subjective qualities, the emotional qualities, that idea of connection that we bring into meditation. And this is something which I first encountered through... the teachings of Ajahn Brahm and also my own metta teacher, Ajahn Mahachatchai, who emphasised this attitude of what are we bringing to the meditation. It's a bit hard to quantify or to explain it in too much detail. I remember a number of years ago I was in a Thai forest monastery of Ajahn Dunn, who's one of the well-known disciples of Ajahn Chah. And at that time, there was a few Western monks staying there, and one of them, as an American monk, his mother came to stay in the monastery for a little while. And she also was a meditator, and she had the chance to come and ask Ajahn Dhan about meditation. And she wanted to know about Maranasati, about how to do meditation on recollection of death. And so Ajahn Dhan gave some very simple instructions, you know, to recall or bring to mind a skeleton or a dead body, and then to remind yourself that you two are of that same nature until you have that kind of feeling of letting go and dispassion that comes. It's like a coolness that comes from that kind of lack of attachment to life. And what was interesting to me was when Ajahn Dhan said this, then... the lady who was asking the questions and said, but how do I make that happen? Right? How do I get from, I mean, I can imagine a skeleton or something like that, but how do I actually make that feeling of dispassion come? And Ajahn Dhan just said, that's up to you. So he's one of the greatest meditation teachers, and we have meditation masters. He's not giving you all the answers. Yeah, it's up to you. You have to figure that out. And this is very personal and very individual. Again, another one of the good lessons I learned about meditation was from one of the books of Ajahn Mahabua. Now, I read this so many years ago, I can't even remember all the details now, but the basic idea was that he was practicing in his meditation. He got to a certain point in his practice where there was some obstacle. Now, I can't remember what the obstacle was, but something happened. And he tried all of these different things to try to overcome this obstacle. Nothing worked until finally he found something he could do, and then he overcame that obstacle and kept on practicing. So that's fine. Sometime later, the same problem came back again. Right? And so he thought, I know the answer to this. Right? So he did the same thing that he'd done the time before. Didn't have any effect. Right? Didn't help him at all. Yeah? So again, this is the idea. It's not about the method or something like that. The same method might work in one time and not work in another time. Might work for one person, might not work for another person. Right? But what actually helped Ajahn Mahabua to overcome that problem was the enthusiasm he brought to it, the inquiring mind that he brought to it, the lack of complacency that he brought to it, right? He knew this was a problem, and he brought wisdom and mindfulness to that problem. And so he was able to overcome it. So this is what I mean by what do you bring to the meditation. So don't come to learn meditation. Yes, we give some general guidelines and so on, but don't come thinking that everything's, all the answers are going to be given to you on a plate. Yeah, actually, we can only do a little bit. So we try, when we're teaching meditation, we try to do what's going to be good and helpful. All right? And I really want you all to have good meditation. So I'm trying my best to say things that's going to help you to have good meditation. But what you do with that is up to you. Right? Sometimes you'll say, okay, I'm going to go away, I'm going to do what Bhante Sujato said, and you try it out and you think, that's rubbish, that didn't get me anywhere. So it's okay. If it doesn't work, that's all right. You try something else. Yeah. So I'm just trying to share these just to try to see if we can help as many people as possible. Okay. Next question. Is empathy inherent or can one develop it? Okay. You can develop it and it's not inherent. Actually, according to... thank you very much. According to the Buddha, thank you so much. According to the Buddha, really nothing is inherent, actually. I mean, sometimes we can use these words, but basically everything is conditioned, right? So empathy and compassion and so on, like anything else, is something that can be conditioned. It's not something that you either have or you don't have. And in this respect, Buddhism, like so many others, Buddhism has been way in front of the game as compared to Western psychology up until quite recent years. The idea that we can sort of consciously develop and grow our empathy and compassion is an idea which is still relatively new in Western psychology. But according to the Buddha, all of the things that happen in our mind, all of the qualities that happen in our mind are conditioned. That's all. Yeah, they're just conditioned. This wonderful phrase from the Potapada Sutta, Sikha Eka Sanya Upajanti, Sikha Eka Sanya Nirujanti. By means of a training, then certain perceptions arise. By means of a training, then certain perceptions cease. It sounds almost, you know, one of these sayings, it's quite, you know, what's the Buddha getting to? But it's this notion of training. His notion that, and training in Buddhism just means doing, you keep doing the same thing again and again and again, basically, is what we mean by training. And this is something which is more and more backed up by neuroscience, for example. Even though I don't really like neuroscience, I've become more and more of a neuroscience atheist, really. I don't really believe, I think it's a lot of fooey, a lot of it. But anyway, so one of the things that they have shown in neuroscience is that when you tend to, the phrase they use is the neurons that fire together wire together. That's the phrase they use. So the more you use your mind in certain ways, then the neurons and so on which are associated with that will be fired and used again and again and again. And because of that, they'll become stronger and the mind will tend to go that way. And the pathways that you don't use will tend to fall away and to decay. So that the more you develop things like compassion and empathy, the easier it is to do it in the future. So, one of the reasons, I mentioned I'm a bit of a kind of neuroscience skeptic, but one of the reasons, there's many reasons for that, but one reason is because I don't think that we can reduce compassion or empathy to something that happens in your brain, right? I think that these things are complex phenomena which have a lot of different aspects. And some of those aspects might be reflected in some things that happen in your brain, but I don't think that's by no means the whole story. And one of the things here is that with something like compassion as a complex phenomena, it involves many different things. For example, it involves your actions, right? So compassion is an action. It's something that you do. It's not just something you feel, right? It expresses itself in your behavior, expresses yourself in your choices, expresses itself in your thoughts and your words. And all of these things are part of what we mean by compassion. But in addition to all of those things which we can recognize externally, there's also a mental quality, which is the mental quality of compassion or of empathy. And that's what we can consciously develop that in our meditation. But even though we're developing it in meditation, hopefully it doesn't remain in meditation. Hopefully it has broader impacts. Okay, next question. Venerable Sir, whenever I try to get for a meditation session or a Dhamma talk, I get these sudden flashes about previous sins that I've done. No matter how hard I try, how many good things I'm doing, it seems to be it keeps on coming to my mind. It makes me really worry. It only happens when I try to get involved in a good work. In a retreat or meditation or going to hear about karma. Please advise me, thank you. Well, that's a bit unusual, I have to say. Congratulations. I mean, normally if you do something good, then that encourages you to remember the good things, yeah? So if you do something good and it encourages you to remember about the bad things, then that's a bit distressing, right? Because it's like negative conditioning right there. You know, you're trying to do something good and then the bad thoughts, so that's discouraging you from doing what's good. So the first thing is to don't let it discourage you, okay? Keep doing good things. Even if those flashes from bad karma comes up, that's okay. That's in the past. So just remind yourself that all of those things are in the past, yeah? Now, if we really take this idea of rebirth seriously, then we've all done lots of terrible things. Yeah? Many of you may have heard there's a simile the Buddha did about rebirth. He said that he asked the monks, which is greater, the water in the great oceans or the tears that you've shed through the round of samsara? Yeah? And the monk said, the tears that we've shed in the round of samsara is greater than all the waters in the great ocean. Yeah? So that's a very powerful simile, isn't it? But nobody beats the Buddha when it comes to similes. And just when you've heard what you think is the most powerful simile, the Buddha gives an even more powerful one. And this is one that he only occurs one time in the suttas when these monks came to see him. And the Buddha said, what do you think, monks? Which is greater, the water in the four great oceans or the blood that is poured from your head when you've been executed as robbers and murderers in the past? Or when you've been killed as cows or animals in the butchery? And they said, the blood that we've shed is much greater. And the Buddha said, yes, that's right. The water in the great oceans is tiny, it's small, it's insignificant. And the blood that we've shed is much greater. So if you want to go back and look into the past and look at all of those things that's happened, all of the sorrows, all the bad choices, all the bad karma we've made, we all have that. It's all there. And so that should cause us to have a great humility. Yeah? We should always be very, very slow to criticize others, very slow to judge, right? Very slow to punish others. And we should also be very slow to do that for ourselves. Remember, in Buddhism, we don't have any idea about guilt, right? So guilt has this, we have an idea of remorse, but not about guilt. What's the difference between the two of them? The difference is remorse. You remember what happened in the past and you feel like a sense of sadness because of the bad things you did in the past, right? What guilt does, guilt means punishment, okay? So that's what happens in the court, right? The judge says you're guilty. The next thing, this is your punishment, right? That's guilt. And so there's no notion of guilt in remorse. It's guilt in Buddhism. We have remorse, but not guilt. Okay? So remember all of those bad things you've done in the past. When they flashes come up, you just remember, oh, okay, that's happened. It's in the past. I've made mistakes. I've done those bad things. Now I let them go. And I keep trying to keep just doing good now. Remember, everybody has those bad things in the past. Perhaps there must be some reason why these flashes are coming for you. But whatever that reason is, don't see it as a bad thing. You see it as an opportunity. You're learning. And most of the time, we are in denial about the things we've done. We forget. We try to ignore it. And so we think that we're somehow protected. Yeah, we can do all of these good things and so on, and that our bad karma isn't going to catch up with us. And meanwhile, the bad karma is lurking in the background, waiting for an opportunity. Yeah. So we all have that. So at least you're aware of it. Yeah. At least you know that that is there. So that's a good thing. So don't worry about it too much. When those flashes come, you just accept them. You say, okay, that was done. It's in the past. I won't do that again. Moving ahead. Now, what can we do for the future? Okay. Okay, I'm after surgery 1 year ago. I'm getting better every day. I'm under treatment. I'd like to know, Reverend Sir, whether metta meditation will help. I have no doubt meditation will help, but please let me know. Okay, well, if you have no doubt, why are you asking the question? I think you probably do have some doubt. That's my thought. But anyway, will metta meditation help? Yes, no, and maybe. Okay, yes, no, and maybe. Yes, metta meditation will help you to feel better. It'll help you to be happier. It'll help you to let go of anger. It'll help you to be more peaceful. Okay, no, it won't stop you from getting sick. No, it will not stop you from dying. Right? Maybe, will it help to alleviate the symptoms of your illness and help you to heal better? Maybe, yeah. Because metta makes your body energies work together and your you know, everything's going nicely together and there's less tension and so on. So that might help, but it's not necessarily going to help every time. Some kinds of illness, they just have some physical cause and you can do metta for it all you like. It's not going to make any difference. When I was a young monk, you know, I was developing this metta meditation and my knees were rapidly deteriorating when I was in Thailand. And I used to do metta, spread metta to my knees and hopefully my, you know, so that I could keep on walking and stuff. It didn't do any good. The tendons and ligaments were broken. The meniscus was torn. You can do metta for it all you like, but basically meniscus is torn. There's no blood flow to that part of your body. It's not going to get any better, right? So I did metta meditation for it for a year. It didn't do any good. And then I went to the hospital and they snipped out the meniscus and then I was okay. So don't mistake meditation what it's for. All right. How are we doing for time? Okay, 10, 15. Okay, more questions. Why do simple approaches get convoluted? That is a very good question. Is there a way to watch this? Why do simple approaches get convoluted? It's actually it's a very good question. I don't think there is just one answer to that. But what I would point to is the role of wisdom. And wisdom is what allows us to make sense of many things, right? With one insight. Okay. This is similar to the idea, if you've done science and things like that, then, you know, basically a good hypothesis in science is one which allows you to account for a wide variety of data with a simple hypothesis, right? And that's considered to be a good or powerful theory or hypothesis in science, right? So it's a similar thing in your meditation and so on. So, for example, sabbe sankhara anicca. It's very simple, yeah? All conditions are impermanent, yeah? One thing. You can remember that easily, and you can apply it in so many circumstances, right? So that's that kind of insight which will, when you have that wisdom, it will cut through the complexity of things, yeah? And you can actually see to the heart of what's going on there, right? But of course, sometimes if our wisdom isn't strong enough, then you forget, and you don't know how to apply it in those different circumstances. And so we get all these details. This is how you apply impermanence here. This is how you see impermanence there. This is how you see it in the other one. And this is what impermanence means in that context. And this is what it means philosophically. And this is what it means in meditation. And this is, and so it becomes a very complicated thing, right? And actually, you can sweep all that aside, and you can come back to three words: sabbe sankhara anicca. Right? And you can look at in Buddhist history. It's a wonderful history of Buddhist philosophy, right? Now, I'm kind of a hobbyist in Buddhist philosophy. I like to read different people and their, you know, they discuss and different treatises and textbooks and so on, and they'll look at this impermanence from different ways. And it gets very subtle and very complicated and very hard to understand sometimes, yeah? But, you know, when I'm reading those things, I never get kind of worried about it because I never mistake it. You know, you understand this is how people are trying to articulate a subtle thing, you know, in particular, for a particular reason, a particular time, a particular place. Underlying all that is still just that one idea, sabbe sankhara anicca. So if you don't want to read all the complex philosophical books and all of those kinds of things, you know, I don't do it because I think that you have to do it. I do it because I find it fun. But if you don't find it fun, that's all right. Sabbe sankhara anicca. That's all you need to know. And their wisdom will cut through that complexity and you see things in a simple way. Okay, next one. Sorry, just trying to figure out the handwriting here. How to integrate into practice effectively, how to balance another something and non-Australians? How to balance Australians and non-Australians? Is that what it says? Ah, austerities and non-austerities. Okay, that's good. That makes a lot more sense. I thought you were saying, like, you know, how much should you listen to Australian monks and how much should you listen to that? I don't know. austerities. Oh, okay. All right. Yes, okay, I see now. Well, we all know that the Buddha taught the middle way. And you know, the middle way between too much austerity and too much indulgence. And, you know, it seems that most of our spiritual life is bouncing around between the two extremes, isn't it? Yeah, not just our spiritual life, our lives altogether. There's a lovely little sutta in the Pali Canon. I can't remember which sutta it is, but one of the Buddha's told about the practices of one of the religious practices at the time, and he said that people will come along and they'll do a temporary ordination. Right? This is in one of the Shramana sects, not in Buddhism. They'll do a temporary ordination, and then they'll fast and do austere practices and so on, and they'll get really skinny and thin and haggard. and then after a while they'll disrobe and they'll go back to their family life, and then they'll eat again and they'll get really fat and so on again. And the Buddha just says, ah yes, well that is how there comes to be the increase and decrease of the body. So Buddha sometimes is very droll in his responses. Yeah, oh yeah, well that's, your body gets bigger and smaller, yeah, so that's how, if that's what you're interested in, you can do that and your body will get bigger and smaller. But you know, and that's what happens even today, right, with when people go on diets, right, isn't it? To exactly the same mentality, right? I'm going to eat lettuce leaves for a week, and then now that I've eaten lettuce leaves for a week, I can eat chocolate cake for a month, right? And they've shown that these things, you know, these ideas the Buddha was talking about all these years ago, it's being shown more and more in psychology to be true. For example, if you have only a grapefruit for breakfast, you think, okay, I'm not going to have bacon and eggs for breakfast, I'm not going to have anything fattening, I'll just have a grapefruit, then you're much more likely to have cake for morning tea, yeah? Because, well, I've already had, you know, I've already let go of all those things, so why, it can't hurt now, right? And this is how the mind works. Yeah? So we're always kind of bouncing around from one extreme to the other. And one of the things that I've noticed is that the Buddha made the world's first ever weight loss diet. Did you know that? See, many things that the Buddha did that he's not appreciated for, right? People think he's only a great meditation teacher and philosopher and so on. But, you know, the world's first weight loss diet, the world's first fashion design, okay, and longest lasting, right? We're still wearing it today, okay? It's pretty good, isn't it? And so many things that you find that the Buddha did, and very well. So first weight loss diet happened when King Pasenadi came to see the Buddha, and he'd been indulging too much and eating too much and was very fat and was like huffing and puffing when he came to see the Buddha. And the Buddha gave him a teaching on moderation and not eating too much. And he made a short verse on the subject of not eating too much. And he said, you just eat one bowl of rice at a sitting, not more than that. And he taught it to one of his attendants. And so the attendant was supposed to recite this verse any time that King Pasenadi ate more than one bowl of rice, then his attendant had to say this verse. And so again, you know the Buddha's way of doing things is always based on kindness and helping people. It's not based on controlling them, right? He's not stopping him from eating it. He's not saying he has to do anything special, right? There's no special diet. He doesn't have to join a Weight Watchers plan or anything like that, right? He doesn't have to learn all the nutritional facts about everything. Just don't eat too much, yeah? And when he eats enough, then there's a reminder, that's enough, yeah? World's best weight loss diet. Don't eat too much. Nobody's ever come up with anything better than that, right? So this is the approach to austerities. You know, we just not too much, just enough. And this is something which I think, we're used to seeing this. I think in a Buddhist tradition, we're used to seeing this as being something which is virtuous. Okay. So to give up, to practice simplicity, to practice contentment, it's a good thing to do, and it's something which is useful, good for yourself and good for others. But I think that we are now entering a new time in history. I think that our civilization is at a turning point, and I think in the future this is not going to be something that's a good thing to do. It's going to be something which is essential. And I think we've reached a point in our development. We've used so many resources on our planet. We've done so much harm to the environment. We've stripped our planet, stripped everything, and we just can't keep on consuming and using and having and growing in the same way. It's just not going to work. Maybe it's too late already, I don't know. But I was at a conference in Vienna a few weeks ago, and we'd had an interfaith conference, and one of the panels that I went to was on climate change and the spiritual response to climate change and the threats to the environment. And one of the speakers, who I didn't know, he got up and he spoke very well about it, and he came to this point, and he paused for a minute in his speech, and he was searching for a word, and then he said, Nekama. I didn't even know he was Buddhist, right? He's just a guy in giving a talk at a conference, and he said, we need Nekama. That's the word that came to his mind. And then he found, what's the English word? Renunciation. Yeah, this is what we're going to need. And I spoke to him afterwards, and it turned out that, of course, he was a Buddhist. And so this is something which is now being spoken about in the highest circles of governments, the UN and these kinds of places, about what do we need in order to survive the 21st century. Yeah? And we're all going to need to become a lot more content. So we either do that one of two ways, right? We either do that disgracefully, right? You try to grab what you can, hold on to it as long as you can, and until finally it's ripped away from your grasping fingers, right? Or you do it gracefully, yeah? You do it the Dhamma way, by practicing, beginning with inner contentment, beginning with being able to find the happiness inside yourself. Yeah? When you find that happiness inside yourself, then all of those externals, they're fine, they're nice. If they're there, it's good. If they're not, it's okay. It really doesn't matter too much, you know? And I've kind of noticed since I've been staying here in Colombo that we've been picked up and driving around to different places. And sometimes we, you know, like this morning, we get down and somebody's there with a nice new Mercedes. And we get in this very, very luxury car, and we get there and we go from there and we come here, and that's very nice. Sometimes they pick us up in an old beat-up van, and we get up and pick us up and they bring us there. Actually, you start in one place and you end up in the other one. Takes the same amount of time. It's pretty much the same, actually. It doesn't really make too much difference. Yeah, it's a bit nicer sitting in a Mercedes, but it doesn't make that much difference. Yeah. And so this is, I think, the lesson that we have to learn. It doesn't actually matter all that much. Yeah. All of these kind of luxuries and things that we're getting used to. You can live very, very simply with very little. There are a few things that human beings need physically. You know, we need a clean place to stay and to sleep. We need a clean, good water supply. We need clean, good food supply. We need medicine when we're sick. We need some clothes to keep us cool and warm, protected from the elements, right? A few things like that, a few basic physical necessities. When I was in Thailand, I stayed in the forest monasteries there. And, you know, I came from a reasonably well-to-do middle-class family in Australia. And we went to these villages. And you can see all these villages from an Australian point of view. They're very poor, right? They've got very little, yeah? Kind of a wooden house and, you know, just a few possessions, very little compared to what I was used to in Australia. But then we go and we're staying in the forest monastery. And we have much less than they have in the village. Yeah, and I'd be staying in the forest monastery, and some of the places I stayed in, literally, you just have a small little hut with a. And the forest monastery kutis in Thailand, I've seen, are much simpler than the ones that I've seen in Sri Lanka. I don't know if that's generally true, but certainly that's what I've seen in a lot of places. Just a wooden floor, bamboo roofs, bamboo walls, and a leaf roof, and that's it. No chairs, no beds, no electricity, no bathroom, no nothing. And, you know, I remember one day I was in that little hut and I was looking around and, you know, I could see, well, what do I have here? And there's like my monk's robes, my bowl, a little mat like this to sleep on, a cup, a candle and matches, a couple of things like that. And that's all. And I sit sitting there in the hut and I'm thinking, what do I want? What could make this better? And I just couldn't think of anything. I couldn't think of a single thing that I wanted. So I still try to keep that practice. I don't have it here, but I have my, when we saw when we arrived, I have my monk's bag, right? When I arrived in Vienna, I got off the plane and some people came to meet me at the airport and I only had my monk's bag with me. And then they said, Bhante, we have to go to the luggage and collect your luggage. And I said, no, this is all there is. And they said, that's your only luggage, that's all you brought. And I said, no, you don't understand. This is my monk's bag. This is not the luggage that I brought with me. This is everything that I own in the entire world. That's everything. 47 years, not much to show for it. Yeah. So we don't need that much. Yeah? And the things that are really valuable in our life is not the flashy cars and the flashy houses and all those things. The things that's really valuable is having family and friends, yeah, people that we love and people that care for us, having that spiritual path, the spiritual meaning, the practice of Dhamma that we can do, being able to meditate, being able to find peace and contentment wherever you are and whatever is happening. These things are really meaningful. All right? When you die, somebody does a eulogy for you, they're not going to say, oh, they were such a great person, you could tell because they drove such a good car. Oh, I know this person must have been really worthwhile because they had a very flashy house. That's not what they're going to say. They're going to say, oh, I remember that kindness that person did. I remember that sincerity that person had. I remember when I was having a hard time and they came and helped me. Yeah, these are the things that matter. Okay. All right. Oh, we're getting close. We're already 10:30 and we've still got lots of questions to go, so I'll have to go through. Okay. How can we deal with images that sometimes arise? So strange beings, etc. Are they sankharas? Well, yeah, they're sankharas. They're sankharas. Everything, any kind of activity in the mind is a sankhara. But if you're meditating and you have images that arise in your meditation, don't worry about them. Okay, just don't give them importance. What's important is your meditation. That's what will get you enlightened. Okay, seeing different kinds of images and things is completely irrelevant to your meditation. So if you see them, that's fine, but just don't give them any significance. Just, oh, okay, the mind's throwing up a vision, and then come back and get on with your meditation, all right? So these things are, I mean, spiritually, they're just a bit meaningless. I mean, we see things all the time, and then people think, oh, is that true or is it not true? But in the end of the day, who cares, really? Is even if it is true, is it going to get you enlightened? Right? I mean, let's say you're meditating and you see a vision of something that's going to happen later in the day, and then it comes true. What do you do then? Oh, I'm going to go and meditate, and every time anything comes, you're going to think, oh, this is going to happen later in the day, and you're going to try and think you're some kind of psychic. Well, so what? So what if you know what's going to happen this afternoon? Who cares? I can tell you what's going to happen this afternoon. Greed, hatred, and delusion is going to happen. Right? And if you can't find a way of escaping greed, hatred, and delusion, you're not going to find a way of getting out of suffering. Yeah. So, in fact, there's been some research done which suggests that we're seeing the future all the time. And there's a very interesting research that was quoted by Rupert Sheldrake. And there was a study that was done on dreaming. Okay. Now, they wanted, because we know that we sometimes dream of things that's happened in the past, right? Something happens during the day and then we have a dream and that comes up. So this study was done to see, do we ever dream of the future? Okay? So they got a bunch of people, they got them to write down their dreams, and then they tested whether the dreams correlated with anything that happened to that person in the previous 48 hours or in the subsequent 48 hours. Okay? That was how the study was constructed. And what they found was quite astonishing. They found, to their complete surprise, that the numbers were about equal. People dream of the future roughly about the same amount of time that we dream of the past. Yeah? The difference is that we usually don't notice it, because when something comes from the past, you recognize it. If something comes from the future, you don't know what it is, and by the time it happens, you've forgotten that you dreamed about it. Yeah? Very interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I'll give you one example of that. This is quite a funny example. Somebody had a dream that they were being chased by a doctor, like a man in a surgical mask and a doctor's outfit, who was carrying a huge syringe and trying to inject them with a huge syringe, right? Now, if you heard that dream, then you could think, well, there's many things, right? If you might think, well, it's a fear of doctors and hospitals, that's fairly rational. If you're Freudian or something like that, you're thinking, well, this guy's got these kind of weird hang-ups and he's being chased around. But anyway, you've got plenty of psychotherapeutic interpretations you could put on that, right? after having that dream, that fellow had a business trip. He got in his plane, he flew to another city. When he arrived at the next city, he rang a friend of his. His friend said, "Oh, let's go out, we're going to a party." They got to the party. It turns out it was a fancy dress party. Someone shows up at the fancy dress party dressed as a doctor with a huge syringe. And halfway through, they were playing a game and he was chasing him and he was like, "Oh my God, that's this dream that I had." So these things happen. So again, if that happens in your meditation, so what, right? Are you going to enjoy the party anymore because you knew it was going to happen? Yeah. So don't worry too much. Visions and so on, don't worry. Okay. Next one. When I do breathing meditation, a lot of hateful thoughts come from nowhere. They do not come from nowhere. That's delusion. They come from greed, hatred, and delusion. Please tell me how to get over it. I try metta meditation in between, but it doesn't seem to help. Okay. So when the hateful thoughts, remember, they don't come from nowhere. They come from you. Sorry. All right. I know it's hard to accept, but it's true. But you also have to understand, everybody has greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay? Everybody sitting in this room has had hateful thoughts coming up in their meditation, maybe with a greater or lesser frequency or intensity, but it happens to everybody. There's nothing special about it at all. Okay, so when it comes up, the first thing you do is you say, "What do you do?" You think about this. What do you do if a little child comes to you and they're in pain? Yeah, they're coming up to you and they're crying. What do? Shut up, kid, get out of here. No, you don't do that. You give them a hug. Oh, there, yeah? Never mind, yeah? But also, after you've done that, you let them go, okay? You don't just keep on hugging them forever and looking after them forever, just enough. They know that someone's listening to them, someone's responding to them. Someone cares, and that's all, right? If you keep on doing it, then they'll just become selfish, right? If you just the kids also have to know when there's enough is enough. So you give them some love, and then time to say, okay, enough. So you think about the thoughts and hateful thoughts in that same way. If you try to shove them aside, try to deny them and reject them, pretend that it's not yours, then they'll become even more tense. They'll have to scream even louder, like that kid who have to scream even louder to get your attention, to cry even harder, right? And this is what happens. This is why these things never go away in our mind when we try to ignore them. But instead you bring love to it, you bring care. You say, "Oh, never mind. You come and you sit down. I use this analogy, I was talking about this yesterday, and I use this analogy of Aunt Sally. Do you know Aunt Sally? Most of us know Aunt Sally. Aunt Sally is the relative who we can't stand. She's like really annoying. And she always comes to visit at the most awkward times. And she keeps on talking on and on and on about all her problems and all the bad things that's happened to her and how everyone's useless and hopeless, and it's going on and on and on. And you're really wishing that you could, you know, there's things you need to do and so on, and you're really wishing that Aunt Sally would just shut up for a while. And so what happens when the doorbell rings and you know it's Aunt Sally at the door, all right? What are your options? Yeah? Number one, hide. Yeah? All right? Number two, answer the door. "Oh, Aunt Sally, so lovely to see you. I'm just so sorry. I'm just on my way out to a meeting right now." Or do you say, "Oh, Aunt Sally, it's wonderful to see you. Please come in, sit down, have a cup of tea, tell me all about it." And you sit there and you listen to Aunt Sally and talking and talking and talking. Now, what's going to happen when you do that, right? She's going to keep on going on and on and on, right? You're not going to solve her problems straight away, right? But maybe you're making a start. Yeah? Maybe Aunt Sally, right? Aunt Sally is so eager to talk to anyone because she doesn't understand how objectionable she is. Yeah? She doesn't get it. She just wants somebody to talk to. She thinks she's being perfectly reasonable. And so every time she goes and talks to people, they always shut her out and they always turn her away. Yeah? And she gets more and more anxious and more tense because of that. And so when you're accepting her and showing her love, it's a long, slow process, but you're beginning to open something up, yeah? To open her up to an acceptance and a sense of being cared for. Yeah? You won't solve the problem right then, but you do that little bit by little bit. So all of those hateful thoughts you're having in your mind, these are like little Aunt Sally's. So you just invite them in. It's a part of you. The thoughts aren't coming from anywhere outside you. The thoughts are part of who you are. And if you try to get rid of them, you're trying to get rid of part of who you are. That's not very nice, is it? And why is it when you do that again and again and again, they keep on coming and knocking at your door? Yeah? So you invite them in. Oh, okay, please sit down. Have a cup of tea. Tell me all about it. And you listen. Listen to what those thoughts are saying. But you don't indulge them, right? You don't keep on getting caught up in the conversation and going round and round and round. You just listen and say, oh, okay. And when you've listened, then you come back to your meditation. Okay? All right. Okay, so I'll do maybe one more, and then we should really break for the dhana time. Okay, this one's similar to the last one, so I might just skip over that one. Ah, okay, this is a good one. Reverend Sir, how does a person at adolescence or teenage years find the motivation to meditate? They find that by getting hold of my book, Dreams of Buddha, which you might see out the back there somehow, written specifically for teenagers, and especially for teenage girls. There's nothing in Buddhism that's written for teenage girls, so I wanted to write a book for teenage girls. And it's all about the struggles of adolescence and how you overcome those things and how you can murder your boyfriend and things like that. So, yeah, you can struggle with these issues. Should I kill my boyfriend or not? Anyway, so Dreams of Buddha is based on the life story of, it's very loosely based, it's like a novella really, but it's very loosely inspired by the story of Buddha Kundalakesa, who's one of the bhikkhunis, arahants in the time of the Buddha. And I was really struck by a lot of her issues. But you know, when kids are that age, adolescent teenagers, then the most important thing you have to understand is that in that age we're trying to find out who we are. And we don't know who we are yet. And if you try to tell them who they are, they'll only reject it, right? Because that's who you are, right? Simple as that. So the more you try to say, let's go to the temple, let's do this, let's do that, they might do it under sufferance, right? But most of the time, it's much better you provide the opening and the opportunity, yeah? You say, you know, we're always there, meditation's good, you're happy to help and so on, and when they show an interest, then you support and cultivate that. If they don't show an interest, that's okay, that's their choice. They have plenty of time to learn, okay? If you can't stuff up when you're a teenager, then when can you stuff up, right? I mean, we all got to make mistakes in our lives, otherwise we don't have a full and rounded existence, okay? Nobody goes through their life getting things right all the time. It's much better to make mistakes when you're a teenager, yeah? So let people make mistakes, don't worry about them too much. And kids will learn. And, sometimes, you know, you see people who they really struggle with this. I had one father from a Sri Lankan family in Sydney. He rang me up in tears, desperately upset and sad about his son. He's saying, oh, Bhante, I need to talk to you about my son. And he was so shattered. And I was like, what's happened? You know, has his son, you know, gone to jail, or has he committed some crime or something like that? And he said, oh, my son, you know, he's gone to university. And I think sometimes he goes to the pub and has a beer. Really? Oh, that's such a shame. That's so terrible. So, what do you say? Well, you know, it's Australia. People drink beer. What can you say? You know, kids, they need to mess up and they need to experiment and they need to make mistakes. You know, I made lots and lots. Do you want me to give you a list of all the mistakes that I made when I was a teenager? That will be quite a long list. Yeah. And you don't have to worry about it too much. The more, and that one, I think, the thing that's really important is that the more people seem to be going off the edge, you know, especially around that age, is not because they're stupid or they don't have any self-control or anything like that. It's because the further out they go is because the deeper they're questioning. Yeah? Yeah? The more extreme their behavior and things that they're doing is because they're questioning at a deeper level. They're questioning society, they're questioning people, they're questioning the family, they're questioning careers, they're questioning all of these things. And they don't know the answers. Okay? But don't stand in the way of their questioning. Yeah? Unless, of course, it comes down to things that are, you know, really causing physical harm or criminal activity and things like that. Obviously, there need to be boundaries, right? But if people are doing things, you know, I just give you one short example. We do have to break up, but just a very brief example. When a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to, I was invited to give a presentation at the American Academy of Religions conference in Atlanta, and I was also invited to San Francisco to visit the Bikunis there. And so we were thinking, how do we get from Atlanta to San Francisco? So we said, we'll drive. So I said, okay, that's good. So we hired a car and we drove across America and through Atlanta and Alabama and Arkansas and Louisiana and Texas, all of these kind of hardcore, the Bible Belt. Anyway, when we were in New Orleans, we had our diner, and then we went for a walk down by the wharf in New Orleans, and there's not many people around, and we're just walking down the wharf, myself and Chandra, my Dayaka. And there's just a small group, two or three young people, just sitting on the wharf and drinking, and you know, they were kind of tats and chains through bits and pieces and leather jackets and stuff like that, and we're just kind of walking along, and one of them calls out and says, you know, hi or something, and I said hi, and he said to me, are you a Buddhist monk? And I said, yes. He said, he said, meditation has changed my life. Right? Meditation's changed his life. I don't know what his life was like beforehand, right? Maybe he was wearing a suit and working in an office, I don't know, but changed his life somehow. Yeah. But this is what you see, you know, he was doing the thing, he was just hitchhiking across America and doing the whole freedom thing, you know, finding what life is about and wandering around and stuff. And sometimes you just have to let people do that. And yeah, sometimes you worry because, you know, it might be dangerous and so on. It's true, sometimes it can be dangerous, but, you know, you can't just live life wrapped in cotton wool for the whole time. Yeah. All right. So we should go and have our dāne. And so from 12 o'clock, come back here for some more meditation, and we'll be doing interviews in the room just over there. For those of you who've written questions that I haven't answered, I'll do them in the next Q&A session. Oh, food hasn't come yet. Okay. Oh, that's a bit embarrassing. All right. All righty. No problems. So the food hasn't arrived. So, you know, sometimes, because, you know, monks have this rule that we have to eat before 12 o'clock, and sometimes if it's running a little bit late, then you get people get a bit tense about these things. I remember when I first met my teacher, Ajahn Mahachatchai, and I went to stay in his monastery in Bangkok, and we had the dāna together in the morning. There's lots of people there, and they're bringing dāna. And I was looking at the clock, and you know, people, there was chanting and people coming and offering, and And the clock was sort of ticking and getting closer and closer to 12 o'clock until finally it was like 5 to 12 or 3 to 12 or 2 to 12. And the Ajahn was like being very kind of relaxed, and he was just sort of taking a little bit from each bowl of food and very carefully and mindfully taking each bowl and giving it to me. And I'm like, well, yeah, this mindfulness thing's all very well and good, but I've got to have something to eat, come on. And so finally we get round to eating, and I'm like, oh, it's 12 o'clock already, I can't eat. And I just sat there looking embarrassed. And then one of the lay people come up and said, oh, Bhante, just to let you know, the clock's broken. Ah, okay, that's good, yeah. Oh dear, okay, here we go. All right, so this one has been edited a little bit, and I've just got to work out what the final version of the question is. Is practicing doing good often, is that often a kind of meditation even without knowledge? So I guess the question is, if you're doing good things, is that like meditation, even if you don't know that it's like meditation? Not really. I wouldn't say that. Don't try to make meditation include anything. Doing good is just doing good. That's fine. Meditation is a form of doing good. So if you're doing good karma and helping people and so on and so forth, then that's a good thing to do. But meditation is something else. Meditation is something which is quite specific and very refined. And compared to most things that we do, meditation is very, very subtle. So I'm just reluctant to try to sort of extend meditation and say, you know, meditation's everything. It's not. Meditation is specifically, it's those things that we do when we sit down and we try to develop awareness and consciousness. However, meditation is supported by all of those other things, and in turn it supports them, so they definitely help each other, but they're not the same thing. Okay, so what do you do when you're disturbed in your meditation? Okay, when you're disturbed in your meditation. A few months ago, about a year ago now, in Sydney, we do this, we have this group who called MedMob. And MedMob's a international movement. It means meditation mob. And some of you may have heard of a flash mob, right? So you know what a flash mob is, where people organize over social media and stuff, and they get together and do dance or some performance or something. And so MedMob is the same thing, except you do meditation. So everybody comes together and they just sit together in a public space. And we've done a number of those in Sydney, but we did one of them near the Sydney Opera House, and there's parks there. So it sounds like that's really good, isn't it? Yeah. So you get like 100 and something people coming along, and you sit in the park and do some meditation, okay? Except when we got there, the council had told us to sit in the side of the park which was next to the freeway, okay? So you got all the noise from the freeway coming. And there's also just next to the city, so you got all the noise from the city coming. So that's okay. But then we were just next to where the opera house was, and at that time they were renovating the opera house, and they were demolishing the front steps of the opera house. So there's all these big construction machines and stuff out there with these huge jackhammers going smash, grind, and it's just there, right? It's not, you know, it's just as far away as that building is, really, a bit further. So then we sit down to meditate. As well as all the usual things like the hot sun and the flies and all of these things. So I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? And I can try to watch my breath, but I'm going to be struggling. So I thought, I'll just meditate on the sounds. Why bother trying to fight it? Yeah? And I just listened. And I just listened to the noise of the city. And I just let it all come in. Whatever came in, that's okay. No matter how loud it is, how ugly, how discordant, just let it come in, let it go through you. And you just feel all the energies that's coming from that, all the chaos, and you just let that go through you. Don't let it don't resist it at all. You have this very nice term in Pali called patiga. Patiga means resistance, and it both means a physical resistance, like hitting something, right? And so when you have a sense impingement. You know, you have like the sounds, they come and hit your eardrum, right? So the patika means that kind of resistance, but it also means anger and ill will, like an internal resistance to things. So I'm just thinking, okay, I can sit here and have a lot of patika. Right? I can try to resist this. I can try to stop the sounds coming in and concentrate, and or I could just open myself up and let it all come through. And it just all came through, and I had a wonderful meditation. I sat there so peacefully for an hour. Yeah, it was so nice. Nothing's a disturbance. You don't worry about it. Anywhere you are, then you sit to meditate. You know, if you're sitting and meditating, you know, if you're sitting at your home and then you hear, oh, it's the traffic noise or it's the neighbours or something, and you're thinking, oh, it's too noisy to meditate. The simplest solution to that is go into the middle of Colombo, sit in the city square, in the middle of all the traffic, and meditate there. And keep on sitting there until you're peaceful. And then when you go back home, it'll be like staying in the most remote forest hermitage. Yeah? Easy. Okay? Okay, we're looking good. Okay, so I'll leave this question for the last. We only have one question, and we go off and we'll have the dharma.